Welcome back, everybody. This is Mark Steiner. That's still Clifton Chenier, and we are here with our panelists to talk about yesterday's election. I want to get your thoughts. 410-319-8888. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages, and you can even jump over and tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Any shocking things for you? What did you think about yesterday's election? Did your person win or lose? What do you think the results were? What did Marilyn Mosby's victory over Bernstein mean to you? What did the Brown victory mean to you? What were the shockers in the Attorney General's race and more? We are joined here by Melody Simmons. Melody Simmons, of course, an independent journalist with over 35 years of journalist experience, writes now for The Brew, and was once nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. Charles Robinson's in studio, political commentator, state reporter for the Maryland Public Television, and Brian Sears, government reporter for the Daily Record, and good to have you all with us.
Morning.
Good morning. You happy, man? You excited?
As I am. Charles is in the house.
Why are you excited, Charles?
You know, I love this time of year, and, you know, I'm going to respectfully disagree with my good friend Brian Sears, who's on the phone.
What do you disagree with?
He hasn't even said anything.
No, it doesn't make any difference. It doesn't make any difference.
Brian, what do you think about that?
Okay, Brian.
Good morning, guys.
Well, let me start with one race. And we're going to hear, I think, shortly that he's going to call in. We have all of you can talk to Brian Frost when he does call in, of course. He'll be calling in shortly, I think. But let's talk about his race before he does call in.
Well, first of all, it got nasty at the end, didn't it?
Middle and end.
But I think all of us who cover the good senator who is now the nominee for Attorney General will tell you he's probably one of the nicest guys you want to meet. I don't remember him ever kind of bringing any disparaging comments on anybody. Brian, you remember any of those?
Yeah, and Charles, you make a great point that Brian Frost, you know, really has a reputation of being a nice guy. And the interesting thing about that is that he for a long time had tried to run sort of the quote unquote nice guy campaign, and everyone watching sort of knew that at some point he was going to have to do something to separate himself from John Cardin, who was really benefiting a great deal from the fact that a lot of people wouldn't understand the AG's race and might look at the Cardin name and associate that with his uncle, the longtime Senator Ben Cardin. And in the end, I mean, you know, he did a really good job. He and his surrogates did a really good job of explaining to people that John was not Ben. And then also sort of pointing out, what he saw as the younger Cardin's shortcomings. And that seemed to resonate down the stretch. I mean, you know, we saw the polls tighten up in June, and that seemed to resonate with voters and push Frost over the top.
Well, let me ask you three what you think really happened there. I mean, and why Cardin lost? Because all the polling up in last month, as you saw, put Cardin way out ahead, and some polls even had Brian Frost behind Brave Boy. And so, you know, I mean, so something happened in the end here. What turned upside down?
I think there were some reports. Brian had some stories, and I think that people really saw, they looked a little closer at the records. And I know the Cardin campaign is claiming that he was being smeared, but I don't believe he was being smeared. I think people really opened up and started looking into it.
I think it was a real simple answer. Undecided voters.
You know, Mark, let me tell you, I think frankly that it was really about name recognition, and after you sort of eliminate the fact, you know, you get to the fact that John is not Ben Cardin, when you look at the polling numbers and look at where, you know, Cardin was strongest, he really did better, you know, relatively speaking, in rural counties, Eastern Shore, Western Maryland, places that were outside of the Baltimore and the Washington market that were not getting a lot of the coverage that we were doing in D.C. and in the Baltimore area. Mm-hmm. But, you know, look at the numbers. Cardin lost his home county to Brian Frost. He lost Baltimore County, where he represented that area for three terms. He lost Baltimore City. He lost overwhelmingly in Montgomery County. I think Frost had over 70% of the vote in his home county. And Aisha Brave Boy, she won big in her home county of Prince George's County. But even there, Cardin didn't necessarily do really well. So when you got away, once you started to separate John Cardin from Ben Cardin, then, right. then and you got farther away from the D.C. and the Baltimore markets, the name recognition thing just, you know, he really ended up having no base.
Sure.
I just want to bring this up before we get too deep into it, is that, and then come right back with it.
Sure.
But one of the things I thought watching this race was, it seemed to me that people were fed up in some sense. This is all anecdotal, but fed up with a sense of privilege. That they looked at people like Cardin. I think it happened in one of the Councilmatic races in Baltimore County, a couple of the races where it happened around the state, that people were tired of what they saw as an abuse of privilege. And I think the smear thing between the two of them, I think that did have an effect on people's consciousness because he lost in the Baltimore area.
I think that's true. Because, I mean, we all knew the information was out there on Cardin, you know, with the police helicopter thing for the marriage proposal. His inability to vote in a committee, you know, that was telling.
That's very telling.
You know.
And that, you know, that what Charles brought up, that piece by Luke Broadwater over at the Baltimore Sun on Cardin's voting record in this last session, missing about 75% of the votes in committee, you know, that really resonates with voters. I mean, you know, you get elected, when you go to the House of Delegates or the General Assembly, you get elected to go there and sit in committee and cast votes. And when people hear that you're missing votes, they don't hear the explanation. They just hear that you're not doing your job. And again, I think, you know, when I was out covering things and talking to people, and again, Mark, just anecdotally, that was what I really got that resonated with voters, was the fact that he was missing votes, and they didn't seem to care about the reasons.
Right. There, but not there.
And I think that's one of the reasons also is people like Todd Huff lost in the Kinney County Council race against Wade Ketch, who ran a campaign that didn't sink down, but I think that Huff's record with arrests and everything else kind of backed people, and the issue around development. I think it was interesting to watch Wade just blow him out of the water.
Well,
that
was exactly what hurt Huff, was, you know, Huff's inattentiveness to certain community groups. He refused to meet with them, refused to go out and meet with the community.
And that had been brewing for years.
He got a bad reputation on his zoning issues that, you know, he had early in his And then I got to tell you, you know, that DUI and the voicemail calling the police chief to try and get him out of it. I think in the end, those things really added up and made it almost impossible for him to win re-election.
Well, there was a grassroots effort to unseat him as well. Don't override that, because that was very important. There were a lot of people, their website, and there was just a lot of efforts to move him out of office because they didn't feel that he was responsive to the development issues in the third.
Sure. So Mark, this was an uh-oh election. In other words, because there was a lot of moments in this campaign from various candidates, you went, uh-oh, this is a problem. And it wasn't just John Cardin. You can talk about the Will Hanna situation. You can talk about...
Well, he uh-oh'd big time.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. You can talk about Darren Swain down in Prince George's County. There were a lot of these, uh-oh, something's getting ready to change the paradigm. You can look at... I'll give you an example.
Look at David Brinkley.
Yeah, that was a moment.
Yeah, what is your analysis of why Brinkley? And talk about who he is for listeners who don't know, Brian.
David Brinkley is the minority leader in the Senate. He's generally seen as a fairly moderate Republican and somebody who was actually able to work with Democrats and give the minority party somewhat of a voice in Annapolis, where generally Republicans are disregarded. The problem is that he got attacked, you know, in a primary election. He got attacked from the right by Delegate Michael Huff. This is probably the closest thing we get to sort of, you know, what you might look at on the federal level as a Tea Party kind of a challenge, where Huff essentially ran to the right of him and said, hey, look, you know, this guy is a sellout to Republicans. He works too easily with Democrats and doesn't sort of uphold the conservative values. And that was a message that played well in Frederick County.
Now, let me move to Baltimore City for a moment. And I think that in the very beginning of this race between Greg Bernstein and the eventual winner of this race, it was interesting. Nobody took her seriously.
Right.
Oh, I always did.
She did. No, she did. She was very...
Let me finish what I'm saying. Most of the establishment press did not take her seriously. I don't think Bernstein took her seriously at all. No. Marilyn Mosby as a challenge. You had Never Don, but he backed out of the race. Now he's going to run as an independent Democrat, whatever that becomes. But I think that she, especially late in the campaign, began to run this very ferocious campaign in the community that really, and I mean the entire community, kind of pushed out there. And I think that he realized too late that he was about to lose. That's the pure political question. I have another one to add to that, but sure. I think that's...
I agree.
I think... Go ahead. You go first.
Well, yeah. I sat at a table with Marilyn at a Daily Record event about 6 or 8 months ago, realized just from listening to her how focused she was. I don't believe that Bernstein realized how focused she was, like a laser beam.
Mm-hmm.
And she's very organized. She's very she's a tough woman.
She's smart.
Very smart. She organized a grassroots effort. She's been on a lot of corners, waving, shaking hands, door to door, as she said. And she really made her mark that way, and it paid off.
Let me talk about two quick things. First and foremost, if you're going to run in the city of Baltimore, you better have black women on your side because they are the largest majority in this city. And she tapped into their angst. Let me talk a little bit about, because I don't think...
But just me.
Yes, but part of it is that, and I had a chance to talk to her husband on Saturday. They had just been at the African American Festival shaking hands, and then we were at the summer solstice. And one of the things he said was, hey, Charles, there is an underlying momentum that's going on. And that is women in this city have believed that they were not taken seriously. And that's the only way to describe it. And this kind of like dismissive thing. To give an example, Marilyn Mosby came down to the legislature this year. I happened to get an email from a group that was doing a legislation on rape victims. Let me tell you, that is a resonating issue for women. Even if you've never been raped or you don't know anybody, they see it as abhorrent. And they felt as though Greg Bernstein was giving short shrift to that in the city of Baltimore.
I think that was part of what went on here. But the two things I want to raise here that people don't talk about, I mean, you look at the Facebook conversations. And let me just lay it on the table. You look at the Facebook conversations, and a lot of people are going, what happened? How did Greg Bernstein lose?
Mm-hmm.
And you see that all across Facebook. And a lot of it is this racial divide in Baltimore? That question came from mostly the white people who wrote on Facebook. I was reading that dialogue back and forth, and I saw in our dialogue between Lester Spence and Chris Merriam, another guest, who both have been guests in this program, about what happened there and why. And I think that was part of, I think that the and sometimes in this world, people in the white community in Baltimore don't know a lot about Anthony Anderson, Tyrone West, what happened to Tyrone West,
right.
How deep that was for people, and how they thought whether that Bernstein didn't, his office wasn't transparent.
You better explain what that is, because some of our listeners might not know.
Well, Tyrone West has been on the show a great deal. His family has been on the show a great deal, and Greg Bernstein was on the show a great deal talking about that because we pulled him in, but then he decided he hasn't been on for a bit, but. It was a young African-American man who was an ex-felon who had been out for a while and was a centerpiece in his family and was driving in a car, had an altercation with a policeman who stopped him. They had an argument. All of a sudden, 9 cops surrounded him. He was on the ground. He was being
assaulted
by these police, and he had a heart attack and died when he was being assaulted. And so, but it seemed Greg Bernstein seemed not to take that very seriously. And also people, correctly or incorrectly, looked at the Watersheim case, the beating of a young black kid in Northwest Baltimore, that they believe he didn't take that very seriously, the people in community. So I think those kind of things added up, and I don't think Greg Bernstein took it seriously at all, nor did he take the black vote seriously in the city, and he lost.
Right, and I think he also depended on the police establishment to back him up.
I do, too.
And you know, don't get me wrong, and Mark, you and I talked about this last night. I said, you know, him walking down the street with Beef, the former police commissioner, I'm sorry, was not impressive to me.
Right.
In fact, kind of pissed me off.
Well, he wrote on that.
Right.
And I erroneously, because it didn't play to his strengths. It didn't play to the image that he wanted to portray for his office. The track record was never brought out. It was never discussed. So there were a lot of issues, and Maryland hit him on all of those and won.
And it's and it's funny that the real quick, we want
to get Brian back
okay,
in.
Okay, yeah. It's interesting because the FOP played a role in Greg Bernstein's ascendancy in the last election.
Yes.
And what did you hear in this election? Zilch.
Crickets.
Nada.
Not a big
crickets.
Crickets. Go ahead, Brian. What were you going to say?
I said, Charles asked what we heard. I said crickets.
And I think the other part here, let me talk about the third piece, then we'll move on to the governor's election, the gubernatorial election, is that this also, in terms of Baltimore city politics and state politics, you see the ascendancy of what I'm, as I jokingly called, said to my wife this morning, as a, to Valerie, as a new royal ascendancy, the Mosbys.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I mean,
oh, yeah. Look, Nick will tell you that whenever you meet him. Like, we're a team. We're gonna make history. And I was like, okay, I hear you.
But I think that they're going to be a political power as a couple to contend with in this town, as the Clintons are nationally, the people are nationally. They've become... They're going to become a force, because if she's going to become a state attorney, if she does a good job as state attorney, he's going to become a force in the city council. There's a mayoral election coming up. There are other statewide elections coming up.
You know Nick Mosby listens to this show.
No, so I think I'm not saying that in a negative sense. I'm not. Go ahead, Brian.
Well, that could be good for Baltimore.
Mark, to bring it back around to something you said earlier, though, about how the public views privilege, that's a double-edged sword when you start talking about, you know, families becoming political powerhouses. If you know, you're not careful, you can run the risk of overstaying your welcome really quickly. You know, the more family members you got involved, the faster you can wear out your welcome.
That's true. I mean, I think the proof in this pudding is going to be what Marilyn Mosby does as state's attorney, how she reorganizes the office. If she does push very hard on the sexual assault laws, if she puts in that unit to work with witnesses that she said she was going to do, and how she's going to organize that office. And she has some very bright people around who are really organizationally very smart. Will she use them to help reorganize state attorney's office? And she said she's going to deal with this, leave that new fancy officer in. Mm-hmm. Will she? We'll see.
There
are things that she's going to have to do.
It'll be interesting.
But Mark, she really has a challenge ahead of her, because
she
it's
does.
Not just reorganizing the office. You know, what is her base going to say when she follows through with her promises to get the most violent offenders off the street,
right. mm-hmm.
and she starts incarcerating larger numbers of African Americans in an African American jurisdiction that, you know, really would prefer to not see their young men going to jail. You know, and also having to deal with the issue, you know, we don't talk about this a lot, but there is always, you know, the specter of jury nullification in Baltimore City juries, you know, which are things that the prosecutor can't control. So, I mean, it's not going to be an easy fix for her just by coming in and reorganizing the office. There's going to be an interesting tightrope for her to walk.
I think the two things that you will hear from her, at least I'm hoping her advisors will tell her, tough but fair. And that'll be a kind of the measure in which she'll be measured against. She's going to have to come down like a hammer mm-hmm. on some of these what I would call criminal institutionalized quadrants. I don't want to call them gangs.
People in communities would like to see the hardheads off the street.
Right.
Well, I also
yeah, tough but fair.
People are going to be watching her because she is an unknown entity, and she needs to hit it hard from day one.
So we're looking forward to talking to her on the air here in the weeks to come.
Call us, Nick. Call us.
And, everybody call us, by the way. We are live, 410-319-8888.
Call us, Marilyn.
We'd like to hear what you think about Marilyn Mosby and all the elections that took place. 410-319-888 is the number, or log on to our Facebook pages, steinershow@gmail.com, 410-319-8888. We'll be right back. We're going out of here with taking a break with Knock on Wood by Eddie Floyd. He was a soul singer and songwriter's birthday today. He wrote this song for Wilson Pickett.
Just a little loving.
right, Eddie. Happy birthday, Eddie Floyd. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Marilyn Mosby did want to come on the show this morning, by the way. Let me just say that she had a trial today. Oh. She is a working attorney.
Get out of that case. Come on, come on radio with us.
We're here with that voice that you know, Charles Robinson.
Can you anyone?
Charles Robinson, Maryland State Reporter for Maryland Public Television. That was Brian Sears, government reporter for the Daily Record. Melody Simmons, independent journalist with over 35 years of experience in investigative journalism, who writes now for the Baltimore Brew. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can join us, and you can also log on to our Facebook pages. Message me at Mark Steiner, or you can 410-319-8888. Call in. We want to know what you did and why. 410-319-8888. Let's go to our first call of the day, which happens to be the man who won the Republican primary, Larry Hogan.
Okay.
Oh, Mr. Hogan.
Mr. Hogan.
Larry Hogan,
hey,
welcome
morning.
And congratulations.
Thank you very much.
So tell us what you think, what these next few months mean. Where do you?
How does Wednesday look?
Well, it's a pleasure to be on with you guys this morning. It's this morning started really early, and
I guess
we've got 132 days left, and we're just going to keep working as hard as we can. You know, it was a great night last night, but that's just the beginning, and we've got a tough road ahead of us. But we think we're going to make this a very competitive race.
So, I mean, the last time, of course, a Republican won was Bob Ehrlich, and it was a while before that since we had a Republican governor. And I'm curious what you think the issues will be that will put you over in a good stead with a state that has a huge majority of Democratic voters.
Well, I believe that a majority of Marylanders, regardless of their party affiliation, are looking for new leadership in Annapolis, and they're concerned about our economy and the fact that unemployment is up 76%. We've lost 6,500 businesses. I've talked to people everywhere who regardless of their party affiliation, are ready to consider voting in a different direction. It really comes down to a referendum on the current administration and whether people want to give Anthony Brown a promotion and if they want to continue with another 4 years in the same direction or if they want to try something else.
Brian, do you have a thought or question for Mr. Hogan or the other, my other panelists?
Yeah, well, you know, I really would be interested in hearing where Mr. Hogan thinks his best chance at sort of separating himself from Anthony Brown is, and does he see this as a third round of essentially what looks like to most of us an Ehrlich and O'Malley proxy fight? It really is a completely different race, but the issue comes down to you know, whether people are happy with our economy or they're not, and the separation is. My complete focus is on jobs, middle-class families, and restoring our economy. And the lieutenant governor has a record to run against, and that's a record of lost businesses, lost jobs, record tax increases. You know, our state economy ranks 49th out of 50 states. We're in really bad shape, so I think that's going to resonate with a lot of people, and I think they're going to be looking to go in a different direction.
Mr. Hogan, Charles Robinson here from Maryland Public Television. You utilize social media through your Change Maryland campaign mm-hmm. to literally upset a individual who has a long career. Are you planning to use that to drive home this, I guess what I keep hearing is this economic vitality, you know, minimizing the number of jobs and people leaving the state. Is that part of the strategy that you'll be employing moving ahead?
Well, yes. I mean, we built the largest grassroots organization in state history. We have 100,000 people engaged and involved through social media, and nearly half of them are Democrats and independents. It had a lot to do with our success in the campaign, and the issues are the ones that really push us over the top. It really does come down to pocketbook issues. That's what this election is going to be decided on. You know, the recent Gallup poll said 47% of all Marylanders would leave the state if they could. And the federal government came out a week ago and said we're 49th in growth. We've had the largest mass exodus of taxpayers fleeing our state of any state in the nation or in the region, one of the worst in the nation. And we've lost – unemployment's up 76%.
Larry.
We've lost 6,000 businesses. So we can't continue heading in the same direction, and we simply can't afford another 4 years of O'Malley Brown tax and spend politics as usual.
Mr. Hogan, it's Melody Simmons. I'm just wondering, what are you hearing behind the scenes from the business community?
Well, the business community is very concerned, as are the taxpayers. You know, again, we've kind of, we're no longer competitive with the other states in our region, and it has to do with an anti-business attitude. CEO Magazine ranks us 41st out of 50 states. Our tax policy, we're the seventh highest tax burden state in the country, and our regulatory policy is unpredictable and burdensome, and those are the three main issues I hear from businesses. You know, we had 13 Fortune 500 companies headquartered here in Maryland under the previous administration, and over the past 8 years, we've lost so many. We're down to only three left, and we've lost jobs, businesses, and taxpayers at an alarming rate, and that's really why I'm running.
Well, we can see where the battle lines will be drawn and what you're going to be pushing during this election next few months. We look forward to talking to you more and hearing you and Lieutenant Governor literally go at it and talk about what the future is going to be. Thank you so much. Well, and congratulations.
Hey, thank you very much.
Larry Hogan, who won the gubernatorial nomination in the Republican Party. So what does this governor's race mean for us here? We saw Anthony Brown just clearly won this election, hands down. People thought at the end there might be this huge surge by Mazier. There was a surge. It wasn't enough of a surge. Brian Sears?
You know, look, I'd like to go back to the Mazier thing for a second because she really did exceptionally well. I mean, there were, the polls had her, just above, in sort of the 12 to 15% range. I think Washington Post at one point had her at 16%. She really, if it were about social media buzz and enthusiasm of supporters, Heather Mazier would have probably won in a landslide. And I think most people who watch these races think that, hands down, she ran one of the best campaigns of the season. But in the end, I mean, she could not overcome Brown's money and Brown's endorsements that he sewed up early from literally every major political figure in Maryland that you could name. And I just think, in the end, it was tough to overcome the machine.
I saw Heather on Monday at Zeke's Coffee. I was in there with Joan having a nice tea, and she walked in the door. And she said pretty much the same thing. She felt that there was great momentum. She was pumped up. But really, the fact that she didn't have the endorsements, didn't have a lot of bucks, it was more of a grassroots social media campaign, she did extraordinarily well for that.
Don Norse told me that early on in the campaign, Don Norse, who's the policy guy over at UMBC, said, people who meet Heather Mazier like her and want to go out and vote for her, the problem that she has is that there's a lack of money, and so she will not ever be able to personally shake enough hands and meet enough individuals, and not being able to go heavily on the air and get name recognition outside of Montgomery County was really going to hold her back, and it did.
Mark, one of the things I asked Heather early on, I said, you're at such a disadvantage. What is this campaign really about? And let me tell you what I think it came down to. Heather understood there was this burgeoning, if you will, group that included LGBT, women, disaffected voters, and they had nothing to coalesce around. And she kind of tapped into their angst, and she gave them a voice. And I think moving ahead, she will almost become that voice for them in the legislative process. I don't know if she's already a lobbyist, so heck, she can go back to doing that. But I think the other part of that is I noticed something that was very interesting. She held her victory campaign in Baltimore City, not in Montgomery County.
No,
and
that's
that,
right.
And that was telling.
Well, I think that, when you looked at the total she did make, and I didn't see the final results, she came in
She beat Gansler. She beat Gansler in this metro area.
It's metro, but not in the state.
Right, not in the state.
She came in second in the city. And I think that when she said last night that her quote was, "We have changed the state of politics in Maryland forever." It was her. And I think in some ways, that wasn't just ego. I think she's right. I think in some ways, what she's positioned herself to do, it'll be interesting to see what happens in the future. But as kind of beyond the group even you talked about, Charles, I think she's positioning herself as kind of a progressive voice in American politics. Where she takes it next is
right.
Another question. But I think we'll see this. If this goes beyond just the notion of this particular election, she takes it beyond this, is something we'll have
as
to.
As a snapshot.
Right.
Sure. I think her voice is going to be, recorded and heard, and we will hear from that base that she formed.
Sure. Can we talk
I think she's set herself up for for the future, whether that's a run at state politics or maybe even something at the federal level. I mean, she definitely has set herself up very well.
Let me go to the phones here.
Oh, go ahead. Go to the phones.
410-319-8888. So your thoughts on this election. And Amy in Baltimore, you're on the air. Hi, Amy. You're on the air. Welcome.
I just want to say that in terms of being a Democrat and what Heather Mazur did for this campaign, and I'm so appreciative of it, I voted for her, is that she did give people something to be excited and motivated around. I could not feel excited about Anthony Brown because I just didn't think that he had any, wasn't really presenting any kind of exciting ideas. And I feel that in the general election, I think that that's going to hurt him. I'm never going to vote for a Republican, but I'm certainly not enthusiastically going to throw my vote behind him. And I think that she just raised the level of debate throughout this whole campaign. So I'm very appreciative of what her campaign did for the Democratic Party.
Thank you, Amy. But I think in some ways that what Anthony Brown election does prove is that in a state like this, that it's the establishment and the moderate liberal vote that is the power base, not the very conservative vote. Maryland's much more conservative than we give it credit for.
The other thing is that, you know, most people don't remember that Brown started his campaign a year before Gensler got started. And I kept asking, why doesn't he just jump in?
Right, exactly.
Because he didn't get defined, but Brown was able to define himself. You know, those early ads of, you know, the family guy, the guy who served in Iraq, all of that. You know, you might not like the imagery, but guess what? You defined yourself.
Charles, I'll take it a step further. I remember last summer sitting up at the filling station up in Sparks, and I had a chance to sit down and have a root beer with the Attorney General, and we talked about it. And this was at the time where he was talking a little bit about, you know, he was teasing us all by, you know, he's in, but he's not announcing. And I asked him about that, and he said, look, it's just too early. Nobody's paying attention. But the problem is that you know, he not only allowed Anthony Brown the opportunity to define himself, he allowed Anthony Brown the opportunity to define him. And what we saw that came out in late September and early October, the stories about the trooper issues, the story about the party in Delaware,
right.
I mean, all of these things began to define him. That party issue resonated with women voters.
My wife reminded me of that.
By not getting in the race, he not only allowed Anthony Brown the opportunity to define himself, taking that away from Gensler, he also gave Gensler the ability to define him. And it was it was something that he ended up not being able to overcome. And then he essentially reaffirmed it, when he goes to Bethesda and he makes comments about Anthony Brown's military. And, you know, it was clearly a gaffe. He didn't mean what but what it sounded like and what voters heard was fit a narrative that Anthony Brown and his supporters built for Gensler.
Right. He was on the ropes from the beginning.
Let me go back to the phone check right back at 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on yesterday's election and what the future may hold. James in Fells Point, you're on the air.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning,
James. What a primary. My question is with Heather Mazur. Do you think, one, that there might be a way for Anthony Brown to tap into her resources, her energy, the focus that she brought to certain communities? And do you think there is a way for it? You know, would he do it? And if so, how might they work together?
One of the things, interesting question, James. One of the things that struck me about Heather Mazur last night and Gensler last night, it seemed that Heather Mazur, unlike Gensler, was very clearly said, let's work for Anthony Brown's victory. I didn't hear Gensler say that.
Right. I think there will be that unity moment when either the three of them or the two of them, the proverbial let's hold hands and, you know, on to victory, that kind of thing. And, you know, one of the things that the lieutenant governor said last night was, Heather Brown brought some great ideas to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's an endorsement.
Heather Mazur, right.
Go ahead, Brian.
I think one of the areas that Brown could tap into is, you know, Heather Mazur's environmental record. I think that could be something that could really help him. The problem is, I mean, you're essentially asking him to do something that really we've only seen you know, from most recently from the president of the United States, where he brings in Hillary Clinton to work for him, and that's kind of an unusual model to bring in a political adversary and bring them that close to the seat of power, knowing that they could turn around in 4 years and run against you. But that being said, I mean there are advantages to bringing her in if they could find a way to do it. The question is will they and do they feel they need to?
Well, and also I do think she did advance the ball for a lot of issues more so than anybody else has. Will they tap into it? That's the question. And especially in face of the Hogan campaign and what's going to happen with that. So I think we're in for a lot of negative campaigning. I think we're going to see a big dog fest coming up over the fall.
The other real quick thing is, I know you want to go to the phones, is that Heather can bring women to the table. Because guess what? Both camps all got all guys.
Mm-hmm.
That's
the question though with that, Charles, is that in the end you look at Heather Mazier's supporters who are probably going to be to the wing of the extreme wing of the party, the more liberal voters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's gonna probably they probably are representative of Mark's last caller who would most likely cast an unenthusiastic vote for a Democrat that they didn't care for because they're never going to vote for a Republican.
Correct.
I mean, I just don't know that there's anything that Larry Hogan or anyone else could do to reach a majority of the voters who support Heather Mazier.
Let me go to the phones here, 410-319-8888, and let's go to Meredith in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Meredith.
I just wanted to say that Delegate Mazur ran an awesome race. And many people are inspired. And really, it's a birth of a new movement, a new progressive movement, particularly in Baltimore City. I mean, just the level of volunteering and the spirit was so wonderful. And we know that it's not an end, and it is just the beginning. We are very enthused about it. And like the previous caller said, a vote for Heather Mazur is not necessarily a vote for Brown. So he will have to work for those votes, whether he wants to or not, or whether he thinks he needs to, that's a given. And also the cancer effect in Baltimore in terms of the state's attorney's race. Marilyn Mosby spoke to the angst of the people, and Gray Bernstein kind of really didn't say anything about it. And so she tapped into that angst and she won. And the point of the matter is the cancer effect. You have to show up to the people or the people will not vote for you. And that's really what it is. Thank you so much.
Meredith, thanks so much for your analysis. Before, let me go here to the phones again. State Senator Brian Frosch has called in. Senator Frosch, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks. Thanks, Mark. Good to be with you.
Congratulations, Brian.
Thank you.
We have our three guests here, our guest journalists, Melody Simmons, Charles Robinson, and Brian Sears are also here in the studio with me, Brian Frosch. And I know that in the beginning of this campaign, it looked very tough with all the polls showing Cardin way out in front. Just politically, just without kind of this, which is the less substantial questions than the others, I think. But just politically, what do you think happened? How did you the surge at the end for your campaign?
Well, it was really the result of the work that we did from the beginning. I mean, we tried to build networks. I had lots of colleagues who supported me. Supermajority of the state Senate ended up with Elijah Cummings, Chris Van Hollen, and John Delaney, all Congress people in Maryland. And the governor came out on my behalf. Governor O'Malley was fantastic. And so it was an accumulation of networks. I got endorsed by organized labor. I got endorsed by environmental groups and teachers. And they reached out to their supporters, their members, and that's what it was. It wasn't any explosion at the end. It was a gradual process, I think, of those folks reaching out to their networks.
And with all due respect, Brian Frosch, let me just say that is definitely a Brian Frosch answer. And I respect that, but I'm just saying that.
We love it, Brian.
Yeah.
That was. Mr. Sears, you have a question for Senator Frosch?
Well, yeah, I was hoping he could talk a little bit about what he sort of did or saw as the challenge in separating his opponent from his opponent's family name, because clearly that, in the end, I mean, I'll go back to looking at the polls. When you get out of the Baltimore and the Washington markets, Cardin does relatively better, but in the areas where Cardin was getting covered, he was losing, and so I'd love to get a sense of of where the how they saw that challenge of separating John from Ben, while not sort of angering a very powerful Maryland political figure.
Well, look, Ben Cardin is a Maryland icon, and that was obviously a challenge in the race. But what we saw in the beginning was that John's sport was soft. It was confusion in some cases with his uncle's name, and in some cases it was just, I don't recognize anybody else on this list. And so there was a dual challenge. It was one, to get people to recognize who I am, and two, to compare me to the other candidates. And so it was really that, it fairly simple, but it was get my name out, get people to understand who I am and what I stand for, and then also to understand how I shape up versus the other candidates.
Go ahead, Melody.
Well, I also wanted to, just hear what you have to say about some of the thoughts that were going on in the campaign, that there were charges of being smeared versus, and then you had the stories come out about the voting record. What impact do you think that had?
I think that had a very large impact. I mean, I think people, everybody has a job, or most people have jobs, and when you have a job, you're supposed to go and do it. And I think people felt that was an important qualification.
Not showing up.
Being there and doing your job.
Senator, this is Charles Robinson from Maryland Public Television. I'm going to suggest that you did a Muhammad Ali strategy, a little rope-a-dope.
Rope-a-dope.
On this. I want to hear the boxer talk now. I want to hear. Is it about people shouldn't take you for granted because you're so nice?
No, you're not the first person to suggest that I've taken too many shots to the head. I'm not. People keep saying I'm soft-spoken and I'm too nice a guy. You have to be tough in the General Assembly if you want to get things done. It's never been a problem for me being tough. It's just I try to be nice about it at the same time, and I mean I try to listen to people and give respect to people. But sometimes you got to take a shot yourself. So
yeah, that's a rope-a-dope strategy. I don't care what you say. That's a rope-a-dope strategy.
You're not the first person to accuse me of being a dope.
So Brian Frost, well, I do want to congratulate you on your run. And the victory throughout the state. I mean, in the Baltimore area as well as in the D.C. suburban areas. I mean, you won both city and county here, and where we're broadcasting from. And look forward to talking down the campaign trail and see what happens as you face off against the Republican and the Libertarian.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Take care, Brian. Have a great day.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Senator Brian Frost, who won the Republican primary. Democratic primary.
The Muhammad Ali of Democratic primary.
And I really, as one looking at this in the beginning, wasn't really sure where that race was going to go in the very beginning.
Right.
I mean,
I wrote the same thing. I was like, why is this a problem?
That's an interesting piece to watch. See how that. Let's go back to the phones, get another caller in here, then come back to some thoughts at 410-319-8888. Mary in Baltimore City, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mary.
I first of all want to congratulate Heather Mazur for being a breath of fresh air in politics in Baltimore. And secondly, I want to just praise and thank Mosby for beating Bernstein, because the cases of West and the Watershines burns in my soul. And I was so happy to see him get beat. And as for the other races, it was okay.
What did you say, Mary? The other races okay with those two? Gotcha.
Those were the ones that I wanted to see something happen about. And I'm sorry she lost. I understand money and politics. And I think she could have done a little more, maybe got people on the street. I don't know why it was a decision not to have poll people. I know I could have got a lot of people if I had been a poll person for her, because I sure would have stood on that street for several hours for
Mary. I saw her on Monday. She was very confident.
She was everywhere.
She was everywhere. She was in Lexington Market. She was all over town.
But Mary was saying, Mary, I appreciate your thoughts, Mary, very much, because I think that one of the things that let me just look at this campaign for a moment. I think that several things seem to have happened in Baltimore City. I mean, Mazeer resonated in Baltimore for a lot of reasons. And I think you're going to find out when you do an analysis of this election, especially here in Baltimore City, that in the African-American world of voters, Mazeer will do better than people think she did in this mm-hmm. city mm-hmm. because of the insurgency, and people thought she was being honest and real and putting it out there, and people could feel and touch that. And I think that was going on, and it was connected to Mosby's race in many ways because of the anger around Bernstein, also the women vote factor mm-hmm. you talked about, Charles. And I think part of the other problem, although not that I think Heather Mazeer could have won, she may have even had a better race had it been a September primary rather than a June primary, but that's not there. But she, let me just finish, but she, the mistake she made at the very beginning, which is a political question here, not an issue question, was that she did not pour money into the old-fashioned lawn signs, billboards, mm-hmm. bumper stickers to put her name out there to the world.
I don't think she had money to pour.
And that came
right. She used it in television ads.
Right.
Let me talk about what Mary just said about motivation to vote. This was a big motivation to vote for a selected group.
We don't want to do that because I know we're going to lose Brian here at the top of the hour. We'll give Brian a chance to have a closing thought before he has to run. Brian?
Well, one of the things that I wanted to mention really quickly, and we didn't touch on it, was some of the really interesting things that happened as a result of redistricting in the General Assembly. You didn't just lose David Brinkley. You lost Don Dwyer. You lost Darren Swain, Doc Elliott, a seven-term Republican. I mean, it's interesting because when you look at who 11 legislators who lost last night, they're almost exactly split Democrats and Republicans. And you know, I mean, you lost Kiefer Mitchell. They threw three Democratic incumbents into a single member district in West Baltimore. So, you know, you lose two really good, you know, legislators who people liked over in that area. I mean, I think that's kind of interesting, and it's going to change the dynamic over and above the 30 seats that we, you know, the 30 or so seats that we knew were going to be empty anyway.
So, what do you mean by change? Very quick before you go, we have to leave here in like 30 seconds. What do you mean by change the dynamic?
Well, I you're going to have a lot of new members who are going to come in with their own ideas. There's going to be a learning process with leadership to figure out who they are and how they fit into the mix. I mean, it really will be one of the more interesting, at least the first session or two, be really interesting to see how they fit into the dynamic. And again, I'll go back to the David Brinkley thing. You put somebody like Michael Huff into the Senate, where the Senate is typically a little more moderate. And he is definitely running to the right of the Republican Party. He's probably going to be more like Alex Mooney and Andy Harris and be a very conservative voice in an otherwise moderate chamber.
Well, let me just say that I appreciate you taking time with us. I knew you have to run for another engagement. Thanks so much, Brian Sears, for being with us.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Daily Record and our other two guests will
be
staying with us here. Charles Robinson and Melody Simmons for the next beginning of the top of the hour. I'm going to read this quick comment here that actually came in from my producer. And what she was, she said she noticed that towards the end here, she noticed started seeing signs everywhere, Heather Mazeer signs, and she thinks those signs everywhere made people feel like they weren't throwing their votes away voting for Heather Mazeer. I think that's a very cogent comment and thought as well. So we're going to take a very brief break. We're going out with Carly Simon. It's her birthday. That's the way I always heard it should be. Happy birthday, Carly Simon. We'll be back here with our two guests, Melody Simmons and Charles Robinson, to continue our coverage of the state's election. Stay with us. George Michael, one more try. It's his birthday today, so we thought we'll throw a little George Michael out there.
Man, you're playing some of my songs that I like.
But listen to the show. This is what we do.
I do listen to your show.
I'm messing with you, my choice. Charles Robinson here, commentator and state reporter for Maryland Public Television. Melody Simmons, independent journalist with 35 years of experience in journalism, investigative reporter who was nominated for a Pulitzer, now writes for the Baltimore Brew, among other
Correct.
Things. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join in on this conversation. Your thoughts in the election. We're going to come to the phones here, see what you are thinking at 410-319-8888. But let's go back to these, some of the races we're talking about. You mentioned some races also legislatively that won in Prince George's County.
Yes. There were a lot of issues around several state senators in the Prince George's County area, including Senator Curry, who won, but had been censured by the body for his issues regarding not following the proper forms for his lobbying efforts.
Right.
And then, of course, the other one is Senator Anthony Muse, who is head of a large church there. Two of them have been bankrupt, and he got through. And that's interesting. However, Tiffany Alston, who had been tossed out of the legislature because she used campaign funds to finance her wedding, was able to get back through. And she beat the person who replaced her, Darren Swain, who had issues of his own following what some describe as a carjacking, and others described as a drug deal gone bad. And, you know,
right, so I mean, Prince George's County is, people don't realize who look around the state here, that each one of these jurisdictions we have in this state are very different.
Very different.
Prince George's County has always been, you know, it's always had this aura, whether it was in the days of being the white-dominated county or
the black-dominated county.
It's always had this kind of aura of, and I hate to say this, people get really angry at it, but it's true, of kind of backroom politics.
Peyton Place.
It's just interesting.
Remember Jack Johnson, the county executive who went to jail
for taking
kickbacks? Like I said, it's
like
a little
Baltimore's always known for its characters.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Weird, strange people.
Sure.
Like Donald Schaefer.
You ready to talk about Anne Arundel?
You
ready to talk about Anne Arundel County?
Sure, I am. Go ahead.
We haven't gone there yet.
We haven't gone
there. Newman
lost. I went down to Anne Arundel County, and the thing that I kept hearing from people down in Anne Arundel County was authenticity. Mm. Anne Arundel was a bastion of blue dog Democrats. It has now had an influx of GOP members, and, you know, it dominates most of that county. Laura Newman was brought in to replace the county executive who was summarily dismissed from office. And the question became, Laura Newman, who was a former Democrat turned Republican who became the county executive.
Right.
And that authenticity, was it her or was it Shue? I think that's how voters looked at it.
Well, she didn't have a lot of experience coming into the job politically. She was a novice. And so she really pushed hard to get her name out. She was everywhere all the time getting her name out there, and it didn't pay off.
You know, and I think that that's true. I mean, it didn't pay off for her at all. And I was kind of shocked. But not really. I mean, because she was also this kind of voice of moderation in that county that mm-hmm. – and it didn't work. I mean, first of all, remember, she said she wasn't going to run again, and then she said then she ran again.
Right.
She wasn't going to
run. And she coined the rain tax slogan that when she decided to vote against the imposition of the fees for utilizing runoff water.
It would be interesting for us that once this all settles down, I'm just to really look at the results of this election, as Brian Shears was talking about before he left, and kind of looking at what these legislative wins mean and how they may reconfigure where the state, Senate, and House may go.
Right.
We talked in the Jordan break in Baltimore City. We saw Corey McCray, who ran this young African-American trade unionist who ran this textbook campaign, won. And with some of the establishment guns really not with him, but the unions were with him. And he won this election, which is really interesting. We'll see what voice he brings to the House of Delegates. Mm-hmm. And there were races like that. So there was some just interesting turnover here.
Sure.
Well, we haven't really talked about the turnout because it was very low. And what does that say? And how do you kind of harness that? That's very interesting, too, to see the numbers. And I think when they start being crunched and we see percentages and then break it down by district, by county, by jurisdiction, that's going to be a very telling portrait as well.
Right.
And that low turnout was not a factor of not having good candidates, but I think it was just the uninterested nature and the timing. I mean, yesterday, it was in the 90s. I went to several polling places. I saw tons of signs. Guess who I didn't see? I didn't see workers out there. I didn't see anybody saying, waving, come in and vote. I went to one jurisdiction down in Anne Arundel County and in Baltimore County. And people were like, dude, we're in our cars. We're not getting out here.
I don't blame us in the heat because I think that the elections have gone, the participation in these elections, especially on the Democratic side of the aisle, have gone down from a high of 40% in the early 90s, 92, I think it was, down to like 25% in the last election, to hovers around that right now. This election may be less than 25%.
I think it's going to be in the teens.
There's a lack of interest in these because, A, it's a June primary, which makes it even worse, and B, I think people are all fed up with politics. And
well,
you know, that's part of it as well. I don't blame it on the weather. I think it's just the nature of the society and where we are with politics in the world.
Remember that primaries are usually for hardcore supporters of a given party.
Generals are low too.
Yeah, well, but think about the people who are interested in these races. I want my guy or gal to get in.
Well, and also you have such a heavily Democratic state. You wonder people just feel like, what does it matter if I turn out? Because
well, it mattered in the GOP because think about this. David Craig, mm-hmm. who most people, he won his home area of Harford County, but he pretty much blew it everywhere else in the state.
Right.
You know, and what Hogan did was he did mobilize people via social media. And that was his key. That was the key that put him further ahead. And if you look at on the Democratic side, early voting told the story. And
early
that was
voting did tell the story. Mm-hmm.
So this has been fascinating to watch how this is all kind of transpiring. And I'm glad you could join us, all three of you, and both of you who could stay over the top of the hour here, Melody Simmons and Charles Robinson. Always good to have you on the studio.
It's always great to be here with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking time with us. And we'll look at more of the election, talk to some of the winners over the next week and as well, and look at what else is happening. And we'll be, of course, following this between now and November. We'll be right back. We're going to have a conversation, switching gears here in the second part of our program here in the second hour. The Reverend Jeffrey Dio will be joining us who from the Presbyterian Church, talk about this amazing decision they made. Stay with us. Just right.